absurdity and stupidity is scalable. And so even with huge organisations and huge departments and projects, the inability of human beings to correctly predict the outcome of their best plan is quite amusing.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Around the end of the recent season of the ABC program Utopia, which is a satire about a fictional nation-building authority, emails surfaced from the Federal Infrastructure Department under Freedom of Information. They revealed that bureaucrats were referencing the show when their frustrations became too great. For instance, during some agonising over the appropriate spelling of the word program, a senior manager wrote, and I quote, "A whole Utopia episode could be made of this, I'm sure." Some Utopia episodes have anticipated real-life debates and decisions, for instance about the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund and the Snowy Mountains Scheme. So no wonder it's been a must-watch among many Canberra insiders. The star of Utopia and its co-writer, co-producer and co-director is Rob Sitch, one of Australia's most talented performers and artistic creators, and he's here with us today. Rob Sitch, have we seen the last season of Utopia, or is there too much political folly about to let it go?
Well, I'm sure the answer to the last part is yes. The first part, at the end of every series, but particularly the first series, we felt that's it, we're done. And because it felt like we'd said all we thought we were going to say, and then over the next 12 months we kept sort of amusing ourselves, spotting things. And Tom Gleisner, who I write it with, is a very good sort of secretary of the meeting, and he has a Spirex notebook that slowly fills up. And when we get to a critical mass, that's when we pull the trigger. But I think after this series, we sort of enjoyed the last series so much in many ways. We enjoyed the diversity of ideas, and I think we're more keen than ever to do another series, but it won't be any time soon.
What was the genesis of the program? It's a brilliant idea, but how did you come to start it all?
It had a shaky start in ways, because there were two threads. There was the office thread, which, you know, we thought amused us, will amuse people. I often tell the story that we were ordering gluten-free muffins, and I piped up one day and said, "Why are we doing that?" And we said, "Oh, because so-and-so is gluten intolerant." I said, "They left 6 months ago." and I think Tom joked, "Should we put the gluten back in the muffins?" And that started us laughing about those tiny little absurd moments that no matter how clever and sophisticated human beings get, they keep plaguing office spaces. And so we did that, and then it sort of led to an insight, or I think it's an insight, that absurdity and stupidity is scalable. And so even with huge organisations and huge departments and projects, the inability of human beings to correctly predict the outcome of their best plans is quite amusing. And you see it tragically in one way in, like, warfare. It's, you know, it's famously unpredictable. But the checks for infrastructure were getting so big, the plans were getting so big, that it felt like there was an element of public service in at least looking at that area.
How do you go about gathering the material? You must have moles in the bureaucracy.
You know, it's funny, Michelle. This is interesting. One of the things, people ask that a lot, and it's the right question to ask, but 90%+ of what we find is sitting in front of everybody, and so it's on the front pages. I think what we developed was an instinct for talking points. Very little gets released to the public now without a media strategy backing it up, and that comes with various depths and financing. And all we felt we had to do was just keep reading a lot, and a talking point just won't ring true, and a media strategy just won't quite add up. And then we used to imagine the sort of the workshopping that went on behind it and do a little bit of digging. But a lot of it really is maybe on the front page of the AFR rather than the Daily Telegraph, but a lot of it's there.
And I'm fascinated by what sort of feedback you might get from politicians or bureaucrats.
In the early days, we were surprised at how much feedback. It was almost like people were saying it was an antidote for them, as in people were stressed, and you know, we live in a modern, sophisticated society with multiple layers, and it was sort of like a stress relief show for everybody. But it was universally, people would drop their voice and say it out the side of their mouth, and they'd say, "Oh, you've got no idea how much that overlaps with my workspace." And lately, I've had people say this a lot. They go, "Oh, that's my world." And I often pause and wait to find out what their world is, because it's often not politics. It's medical administration, hospitals. It's sports administration. And it's, in some ways, the audience reaction has taught us what we're doing, that bureaucracy is endemic in all of these sophisticated organisations we have.
It's hard to embarrass politicians usually, but do you think the political class is somewhat embarrassed by the foibles coming out?
I think the minister responsible for the particular area is Michelle, because they have to go out and spruik and shill for things. But I often find retired politicians, or even politicians that are down the other end of the cabinet table, they seem to be having fun with it.
Well, one does wonder what Anthony Albanese, for example, thinks about it, because, of course, he was the minister and is now the spokesman, Labor spokesman.
Yes, we use Anthony Albanese's nation building. We use him in our
intro
title, which I really love, because it's not quite Barry Humphries, but it's got that little Aussie. It's almost got that little whiff of, should this man be spending $20 billion? Sounds like he's running a trucking company rather than the country. But that's not to disparage him. It's just that lovely Aussie sound that he gives the opening titles. I think the overlap with Anthony Albanese is we did, in the early days, did an episode on a very fast train. And that's, in some ways, that's emblematic of what we would look at that and say, why do we keep hearing about this and yet nothing gets done? And so we did some research, and it became amusing how many feasibility studies were done. And then we realised the wedge that governments were under, in that the last feasibility study said it wasn't feasible, but the sound of it is so good that they can't help themselves and say, we're looking into it. And then they rename the feasibility study, it's a scoping study. But the economics of very fast trains, sort of, I don't think this is quite right, but it's in the ballpark. They're great up to about 500 kilometres, maybe 600, and all the problems start after that. And when you throw in mountains and land you don't own and all that, the chances of it coming in on budget, I think, is zero.
Perhaps it's time to revisit, because certainly Barnaby Joyce is highly committed to that particular project.
Well, it may well go in close proximity to his seat. I wouldn't. You know, that wouldn't be the first time something like that occurs. But it's again, I think human beings, and I'd throw myself under the bus here. It's hard to get an immunity to things that sound good, and you know, you said this is a. I don't think it's a joke. I think it's true. Someone said that Athens almost went broke building the Parthenon in 500 BC, because we do love big buildings. We do love edifices. We do love grand plans and all these sorts of things. But the sugar hit comes early, and the reality creeps in from then on, you know, for the subsequent years. And something, I'll pick one where I don't know what the conclusion is. The Sydney Opera House, I think, got listed as, so dollar predicted to dollar spent, the greatest white elephant in the world.
So sometimes the white elephants are worth it.
So it's also the greatest building in the world.
Indeed.
And is so, you know, the great John Clark said this once when he was defending fighting against the closure of an inner suburban baths. And they said, oh, well, it doesn't, it's not economic, it doesn't make any money. And he said, well, that's bad news for footpaths. And so I think there is a little bit in this, is that in all the absurdity, human beings are doing something that is intuitive as well.
So are you personally a political cynic? What do you think about the real thing as opposed to your reality presentation of the real thing?
No, well, politics is pretty complex. And I think, as Nixon said, you know, I played the game with the rules as I found them. There's a bit of that too. You can only play the game as the rules are currently constituted. But I think there's a role, you know, for us it's a small role. Sort of deep thinking political journalism and investigation, that's a role too. It stops people rorting, intellectually rorting. You know, knowing something's not true, but they can get away with it. I think it's a pushback. If there's a lot of marketing and sloganeering in politics, probably, you know, when you look at America, it's catchphrases and slogans is driving the country at the moment. And so it's just part of the pushback towards, you know, so that public commentary bears some resemblance to the private facts.
So what about the players themselves? Do you think their intentions are good, or do you look at them and think that really it is some sort of rort on the public, not literally, but a figurative sort of rort?
It's interesting because I feel you've probably cleverly wedged me there. I just don't think that they're in a position to... Yeah, I liken it to a schoolboy debate, and that is, they say, okay, the debating subject is that women shouldn't be allowed to drive, and we've all got an instant opinion on that, and you're for the affirmative. And, if anyone that's done debates sits down and starts mounting arguments in complete contrast to their personal opinion, as if it's a game. And I think politics has a big overlap with the schoolboy debate.
Certainly feels like a bit like a boarding house here in Canberra.
Now,
going right back to the beginning, you trained as a doctor. You made one hell of a career leap. What was that all about?
So it was more a hobby that got out of hand. There was no, in terms of planning, that my planning department didn't cover itself in glory there. I was doing, I was at uni and I thought, I've never done a play or anything theatrical, and I tried out for a couple and was given. I think I played the Undertaker in Thornton Wilder's Our Town was my high point. And a friend of mine, who's still a medico, said, "How about we try it for the Law Review?" And we both got in and loved it, and we kept doing comedy reviews, and then took a year off. And so I was doing that as I was finishing medicine.
So no regrets. Never wish you.
No, I still have many friends who are in medicine, and I love that area still. I still read a lot about it, but I sort of look at the rings under their eyes and think I'm not sure I had the stomach for the hours.
So over the years, you've worked with your colleagues on TV, on and off camera, across various genres, including a panel show, a fishing show, a game show, broad comedy, more subtle comedy. Is there any sort of guiding principle in all this work? How do the shows get chosen, or sort of shows?
They always... It's a very interesting question because it makes me pause to think that what's the thread that I've worked out is it's got to be an idea that intrigues or interests us enough to have all of us want to do it for at least 12 months. And so we've become reasonably good at gauging each other's interests by body language. So sometimes we'll pitch an idea and there's a pause from one of us. And that idea goes to the back burner because it's hard to get these new projects up unless everyone's, you know, pulling on the oars equally hard. But that said, the original idea for Utopia, Tom Gleisner and I sat and we just kept loving it, and we were spending a lot of time accumulating ideas. Santo came in and we pitched it, and he had he was less than fully enthusiastic. But in moments like that, we try to work out what's not catching you, because in a way he's the proxy for the audience. And he said at that point we were going to make it about one large block of land where nothing ever happened, but huge plans were. And his advice at that time was, I think you've got to be a bit more specific and a bit more national. And that started us down the track to bigger projects and bigger dreams.
Do you enjoy political satire more than other work?
It's very interesting that I was introduced to Yes Minister by my elder brother, and I must have been 19 or something at the time. He said, now you've got to watch this, got to watch. And I just, the thought of it was, you know, I needed an EpiPen to get over my allergic reaction. I watched it and I went, oh my God, that's just brilliant. And kept watching it all during the time that it was going to air, you know, in the time it was produced. And I maintained for years that's the best TV show I've ever seen, all the way through to Yes Prime Minister. And it's funny that Armando Iannucci, who wrote Veep and The Thick of It, the reason he came into that is because he was forced to watch it for a BBC's top 50 or top 100 TV programs of all time. And he had a much delayed reaction, but the same reaction. He goes, oh my God, this is the best TV show that's ever been done. But because it was so good, I just thought there was nothing more to say in that area, until we felt that there'd been a paradigm shift in politics. And I used to call it the coup. Is it a coup if no one notices? That from the Yes Minister point was that the bureaucrats were running the politicians.
Mm.
And in the Holloman, we were saying, no, it's the unelected sidekicks to politicians that are running the department. And it's, you know, there's a bit of interesting history as when that started and how it progressed. But, you know, you would remember, is it called the Night of the Long Knives when Howard came into power?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Well, I mean, that was more than a warning shot, wasn't it, that where the power was going. That was a bit of Game of Thrones there. And so when that emerged, we thought, oh, so we kept examining politics as it was and then tried to come up with a series. And in the end, where we didn't even have a single politician in the show, it was all about backroom people.
That sort of shift probably started right back in the 70s with Gough bringing in more political staff and being somewhat suspicious of the bureaucracy. But it's interesting you mention those three programs, because not only is that shift reflected from the Yes Minister and then The Thick of It, but also I guess the latter two, The Thick of It and Veep, are more in your face sort of depictions, more bad language, more a sense of shocking the audience. I guess your program in Utopia is more like Yes Minister, isn't it? It doesn't rely so much at all, indeed, on that shock factor.
No, that's a very accurate statement. And that's just, this is just personal. I feel when you're using shock, you're failing somehow. As in not failing, but there's a better thing you can be doing than doing that. And I remember there's a famous anecdote where David Attenborough, when he was head of the BBC, I think at the time, and Monty Python was emerging, and he wandered up to John Cleese at a Christmas party and he said, effectively, here's a piece of advice. He said, use shock sparingly. And I remember reading that years and years ago, and I thought that was just such a clever comment, that it's a very easy thing to turn to, but it displaces something cleverer.
So, for example, are you a fan or not a fan of Veep?
Well, I am. I think Julia Louis-Dreyfus is the best actress in the world. So, I mean, you start from that point there. And I, if I said the second best program in the world, it was Armando Iannucci's Knowing Me, Knowing You, Alan Partridge. That's possibly, I don't think I've laughed harder. So I love all the creators, and I think she's just the most amazing actress.
But do you think there's too much shock value in that language?
There's a different heritage there, that a lot of British comedy, if you look at Blackadder, and they really are very insulty comedies.
Mm.
And so when I say if I get to institute my taste, I go in a slightly different direction. But that's not to say that's the best in that genre. That's the best that could be done.
Now, this year is the 20th anniversary of your first feature film as director, The Castle, which has become an Australian classic. Why do you think that film resonated so strongly and has lasted so well?
It's hard. You know, funny enough, I should probably go out in the street when someone comes up and compliments it and said, why do you like it? Because when you're in on the inside, the things that you loved about it alter over time. And I do think it had a positive, it produced a positive feeling in you. And that is, as a friend of mine said, gee, the goose of a dad's the winner. That just never happens. And I also think that for some reason it got repeated on Channel 9. Almost on an annual basis for a while there, and that meant that people could hear, a bit like hearing a piece of music 10 times, you can actually repeat the lyrics, and so that gave it a life separate from its original movie release, and that, you know, the serenity and how's the serenity and all of that, and so they became catchphrases, is used as a put down. It's not a catchphrase. It's like singing a song you like. So that once it ended the sort of vernacular, I think it took on a life of its own.
Do you have any memories, particular memories from the making of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not the scary thing about adding quite a few years to my life at the moment is I remember things like they were yesterday, but they're not. They're 20 years ago.
You don't forget last week's shopping list, do you?
Oh, I do that. I forget where I parked the car, but I don't forget making that film. It was funny. We did lots of interesting things looking, but it produced a lot of sort of funny stories. We approached the house. I knew where the house was because I grew up near there, and my cousins, we used to go around there and think it was the luckiest house in the world because we all love watching the planes land. And we approached the people and said, well, could we take over the house for a couple? We'll put you into hotel accommodation. They were great. It was all fantastic. So weren't they lovely until we found out that they were renting? We technically didn't approach the landlord. And then other things, it seems so obvious now. Someone had the smart idea of getting a full Gudger cappuccino making machine and putting it in the garage. Back then, you know, what's called craft services on film sets, it was Nescafe International Roast at best. And so we got one of the runners to become a barista and walk around with proper coffees for everyone in the middle of winter. And if you did a sort of a customer satisfaction survey, that turned out to be the greatest morale factor for the whole shoot.
Now, what's happened to that house? I vaguely remember there was some story recently that it was going to be pulled down or something.
Yes, if you live in Melbourne, there's been a constant drumbeat of stories about what happens to that house. And I think it's finally been chopped in half and taken up to a chooker, is best I remember, because, you know, the landlord, the person who owned the property, you know, quite rightly thought, no, I'm going to put units on it, and it was a weatherboard, and it would have been, I think people were looking at heritage listing it, which to me would have been a bit of an irony that a film about dispossessing people of their property rights ended up dispossessing the owner of that.
You probably added to its value somewhat.
Yes, I think, even in the end, it didn't go for very much.
I'm surprised you didn't buy it as a memento.
No, I sort of... It's one of the funny things with the cast, we sort of not had an official motto, but a bit of a motto is let the public have fun with it, and we won't set down any survey pegs.
Now, having worked for a long time across film and television, what's your assessment of the way these industries have changed in that time and the impact of pay TV and digital media in particular on how they've gone and are going?
Well, it's massive now. I mean, you can officially say it's just a complete revolution. But film, I mean, demographics are destiny, and film has gravitated massively towards young audiences because they're the ones that are going. I've got a couple of teenage kids who will go and love a film so much. One film that was recently out, he's seen 3 times. Well, if you're a movie maker and you've got a population of 15-year-olds going to see a Marvel superhero 3 times, then you're going to make a lot of Marvel superhero films. And then at the other end is a lot of things like art, sort of that good art house movies, and that gets an audience for a slightly older demographic. But the middle's hollowed out massively. But that's almost like your Game of Thrones audience, your House of Cards audience, and so it's bifurcated where movies sort of massively move younger and older, and then sort of pay TV, streaming, binge watching is everything in between.
Films with Australian or shared creative control on the whole still have relatively little box office share.
Yeah.
And it was especially low, I think, last year. What, if anything, can be done about this?
Well, it's sort of funny. I use this joke a bit. I go, you know, that thing about how do you make elephant soup? And it's actually really easy. First, obtain your elephant. And when I went and saw Lion, the Australian film Lion, have you seen that film?
No, I haven't.
It's just
but
wonderful.
I have heard a lot about it.
Just a wonderful film. And it's, I go, how do you make a great Australian film? It's easy. First, get the greatest story that's ever been told and then make a film out of it. I think that there's a problem in that movies are kind of global franchises now more than anything. And not only that, I mean, there are people in Hollywood that are crying into their soup because they can't get great stories up. Because people are doing, it's either got to be a comic book hero or an established product or a reboot of a 70s TV show or Star Wars 18. So I think I'm in some ways, whether you like it or not, it's probably wasted energy to fight that trend because they're just reacting to the economics and the demographics. But here, the scale and the audiences now make it hard. I mean, you know, we don't have many Marvel superheroes based out of Australia. But we still have a huge talent pool. You know, George Miller and people like that, you just look at them and they're still making global films. We still have global actors and we still have global cinematographers. And so Hollywood is in some way such a mecca of global talent that kind of drain towards Hollywood of our best and brightest, I don't think will stop.
Do you think in this context then the government should be playing a bigger role in encouraging the film industry, as for example some time ago it did and then things got out of hand and support was cut back, but
yeah,
is there a bigger role for now?
It's funny, that's like I'm staring down a minefield and I know there's a way through with answering that, but I just don't know how to do it without stepping on the mine. It's easy to say let market forces apply. But the argument sort of...
They've got very unfashionable here.
Yeah. But I don't know. I just... My problem is I can't imagine... It'd be sad to see that side of Australia drop away. You know, that it's something about Australian films and, you know, Lion is the latest example of it, that just something gets added to the culture when an Australian film pops out, you know, Muriel's Wedding or... And you don't want to be the person that oversaw the complete death of the industry because that means you're sentencing Australia to never having those iconic things made.
Now, just before we finish, what projects do you have coming up while you're thinking about another possible series of Utopia?
We're currently in the receivership network at 10. We do a Monday night show called Have You Been Paying Attention, and that doesn't take up all of our week. Takes up a fair swag at the moment, and so we do that for 30 weeks of a year and enjoy it immensely. So Tom Gleiser invented a character, an outback adventurer where things go wrong, called Russell Coit years ago, and one of the benefits of the digital channel is they started repeating these old episodes and started rating again, and then the network came back and said, with, you know, any chance that Russell could fire up the four-wheel drive again? And so Tom's and Glenn Robbins have been spending a lot of time producing that. So I think that's going to be enough for the next sort of... And then, you know, Utopia, curiously, takes a long time to write. And so we sort of have to... We've learned our lesson that every series you've got to spend longer writing the next one. And so we'll black out, you know, a good swag of next year to at least put it through the feasibility stage.
So you write the whole series before you start producing?
Yeah. We write. One of the things, though, we've never found a smart way around this, is we, for some reason, we do a lot of drafts and lots of drafts, you know, rarely less than 10. And so once the biggest struggle for us is to get the structure up of an episode and lay it out and so that it's sort of bulletproof-ish, and then, but that still might need another three or four drafts, you know, during the 3 month shoot, depending on, sometimes, you know, an actor comes in and they're just, you want to give them more roles, and so you'd go back and tweak it, you know, as we go along. But generally, it has to be pretty much ready to go when we start shooting.
So your scripts are exact lines, are they? You don't improvise.
There's no improvisation. No.
Right. Now, finally, what shows do you most enjoy watching? Do you, for example, at all reprise your past and watch any medical shows? Or
that's interesting.
Where do you go to?
No, I don't watch medical shows.
They're a bit gruesome, aren't they?
No, I watch medical documentaries, though.
Mm.
You know, so Michael Mosley I enjoyed. This is an odd... friends of mine sort of send me up for this, but I've got a slightly curiosity streak, so I find myself watching Michael Portillo on SBS did these series after series of train journeys, all based around a travel guide that was published in 1913. And I'm a bit of a history buff, and I love the combination of travelling for the purposes of history. And so I found myself watching episode after episode of his journeys around the continent, and it was that combination of travel and history that I really enjoyed. There's a US-British series called Episodes, which I loved, with Matt LeBlanc from Friends, Half Hours, talking about trying to get a British hit TV show remade for the US. So it might be a bit in, but for me it was enormously amusing. Silicon Valley, there's a series from HBO about a comedy about a startup in Silicon Valley. That's really excellent.
So you do watch a fair bit. You don't escape from it all to the garden
no,
or whatever.
No. It's funny, but you're right. I possibly watch less straight out comedy than there's something about when I'm in writing mode. I don't watch much comedy. I just want to be in my own thoughts. But
too much like The Office, as it was. Were.
A little. I watch a lot. I enjoy a lot of sport, you know, international sport. So I'm not immune on that. And I having resisted it for years and years, I've nearly finished Game of Thrones. and I give that the big tick.
Rob Sitch, thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been really good to canvas your work and your views. And that's all from this podcast for The Conversation. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with you with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.